And Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, listeners worldwide, this is your platonically genial host, John Derbyshire, with news of the hour. All is quiet here on our private island in the sun-kissed Aegean. A little too quiet, come to think of it. But Mandy, where are the other girls?
Up on the roof sunbathing.
Oh, okay, I guess. They know not to move around up there while I'm recording, right?
Whatever.
Between you and me, listeners, I think I detect a little residual attitude from my having imposed level 3 discipline after the shenanigans while I was away. Ah, the burdens of management. Okay, let's see what's been happening. Next week, May 21st, actually, sees the opening of the National September 11th Memorial and Museum in New York City. The New York papers have been giving previews of the museum contents. There are fragments of the planes that were flown into the Twin Towers. There is the wreck of Ladder Company 3's fire truck, whose entire crew of 11 died in the towers. There are office workers' desk objects battered and burned. There are photographs of victims, of the hijackers, of people leaping to their deaths, and so on. I really can't say I'm on board with any of this. I've vented about this before, on the anniversaries of the event. There's something mawkish and unhealthy about us as a nation dwelling on these horrors. The bereaved should, of course, grieve for their lost loved ones, and the rest of us should pause when the date comes around to honour the memories of those who died doing their duty. All that aside, I nurse a lurking suspicion that all this emoting about the event is a consolation for us not having had the guts to actually do some of the things that 9/11 rather dramatically showed us need doing. Steve Quazzo in the New York Post, for example, reviewing the museum, said, quote, "It holds back nothing in its message to every visitor. Never forget." Never forget what? Never forget how stupid we were to allow misfits and lunatics from the Third World to settle in our country? Never forget how the George W. Bush administration took a stern line against racial profiling at airports just a few months before 9/11? Never forget how we have continued to bring in tens of thousands of young Muslims from Pakistan, Somalia, Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, creating security headaches we don't need to have? Some things you just need to say once. Here's what I said on Radio Derb last September 14th. I had just reminded listeners that immediately after the 9/11 attacks, President George W. Bush showed up at a mosque to assure us that Islam is a religion of peace. Then I said the following thing. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't, but here is a fact as indisputable as Mount Rushmore. If we had never permitted mass settlement of Muslims in Western countries, many thousands of American, British and European people would have lived out their lives in peace instead of dying in agony and terror at the hands of Muslim fanatics. By continuing to allow that settlement, we doom unknown further numbers of our own people, American people, British people, Danish people, French people, to similar fates. And for that, we are fools, fully deserving of the mocking laughter that undoubtedly comes from the enemies of our civilization as we gather at these solemn ceremonies of remembrance. The comment threads on news stories are interesting to read. You have to take them with a grain of salt, of course. For one thing, most sites have moderators who exclude the most deeply unsuitable comments, along perhaps with some other subset that offends their personal views. For another thing, the website itself carries some partisan bias. Commentators on the New York Times blog are more likely to be urban liberals. Commentators on American Renaissance are mostly race realists, and so on. Any public forum like that attracts disproportionate numbers of cranks and monomaniacs. Before there were comment threads, there were letters to the editor. Back in my newspaper days, I knew the fellow whose job it was to sift through those on a London broadsheet newspaper to see which were print-worthy. Of course, he told me once, a lot of letters are from lunatics. I pressed him on that point. What's a lot? What proportion is from lunatics? He thought about this for a moment, then he said, around a quarter. Good grief. He also told me, though, that if mail on some topic ran in proportions 2 pro to 1 con, he'd print 2 of the pros and 1 of the cons to reflect the balance of reader opinion. I'm going to assume, perhaps optimistically, that some of that sense of responsibility applies to online comment threads. If it does, huge numbers of Americans are at odds with our ruling classes. Take this story from Reuters, May 14th. Headline: Mexican immigrant seeks refuge from deportation in Arizona church. That's the headline. Notice that he's just an immigrant in the headline. The immigrant turns out to be an illegal infiltrator. He came here illegally 14 years ago with his wife, and they've been living la vida undocumentica ever since. They have a son, 13 years old, born here, and so, by our crazy rules, a US citizen. Mr. Ruiz, that's his name, was pulled over for a traffic violation. He was found to have no papers, and eventually he was sent a notice to report for deportation. Instead, he headed for this Tucson church and claimed sanctuary. The church pastor is aiding and abetting Mr. Ruiz in his shameless violation of US laws, to which Mr. Ruiz no doubt responds with a hearty, "Sanctuary much." Reuters writes this up in the usual way as a sob story. "I'll do anything it takes to stay with my family," weeps Mr. Ruiz. Anything it takes, huh? I guess that would include taking the wife and kid back to Mexico with you, where you all belong. The main point of interest, though, is the comment thread. There were over 1,200 comments when I looked. I trawled through the first few dozen, and I couldn't find one that had any sympathy for this guy. Every single commenter wanted him deported, along with his family. This is a Reuters report on Yahoo.com, so I doubt there's much partisan bias there. All the panjandrums of our society, all the media talking heads, all the college professors, all the race hucksters, all the fat, smug businessmen like Sheldon Adelson, Mark Zuckerberg and the Koch brothers, and of course all the Washington DC parasites, the Congress reptiles and Supreme Court judges, Obama and Holder and Sotomayor and Schumer and Boehner and Pelosi and Rand Paul and all the rest of the filthy crew, all of them want Mr. Ruiz to stay here. And no doubt they'll get their way. Meanwhile, hundreds of ordinary, powerless Americans reading this story are shouting back, "No mas!" It'll do no good, of course. Our well-cushioned elites will get what they want, and us working stiffs will have three more mouths to feed, educate and heal. Democracy? Don't make me laugh. I was actually down in Tucson a few days ago. I got talking in the airport bar with a resident of Sierra Vista, a modest town of 40,000 people down there on the border. He told me some of what goes on down there, about coming out of his house one day in a quiet suburban street to encounter 30 or 40 illegals running down the street in a crowd, laughing and hooting, with a couple of Border Patrol agents in pursuit. I'm sure most of them got away, he said. He also told me the smugglers' latest trick is lighting fires along the border. The Border Patrol has to go help put them out, so some stretch of border has no protection. The Border Patrol will get on top of that, explained my drinking buddy. Then the smugglers will think of something else. It's an arms race. Hey, if it's an arms race they're wanting, let's show them some real arms. Do we not still have stocks of napalm? How about daisy cutter bombs? Have we decommissioned those? Arms race? I'd give them arms race. I just wish I could see some sense of urgency about controlling our borders. In Europe, it's even worse. The newspapers over there today have gruesome pictures of dead Africans washed up on the shores of Libya after their boat sank and many of them drowned. The boat was actually a smuggler's boat, trying to get these Africans into Europe. Hundreds of thousands more are gathered on the North African shore, hoping to get into Europe. Why? Obviously because there is no kind of life in their own countries. Sub-Saharan Africa is overpopulated, violent, poor, corrupt and chaotic. Who wants to live in a place like that? Why are those countries like that, though? It doesn't help to say that poverty causes their problems. At the time of its independence in 1957, Ghana, which was then the wealthiest nation in sub-Saharan Africa, had a per capita income almost equal to that of South Korea. $490 against $491 in 1980 dollars. Ghana's per capita GDP for 2013 was $3,500. South Korea's was $33,200. 9.5 times Ghana's. And in 1957, remember, much of South Korea was in ruins from the Korean War. Remember, too, that Ghana is one of the more peaceful, better-run nations in Africa. Maybe it was colonialism. Was it, though? Parts of Ghana were under British colonial rule for 90 years, though other parts never were. British rule ended in 1957. Hong Kong, by contrast, was a British colony for 150 years, until 1997. It has no natural resources. It's just a bare rock sticking up out of the sea, with 7 million people clinging to it. GDP per capita? Over $55,000. 16 times Ghana's. Mean life expectancy in Hong Kong is 84. In Ghana, it's 66. Perhaps colonialism isn't so bad. At last, apologists for those failed countries start to sound like they're just making excuses. At that point, you bring out Occam's razor and say, yep, well, maybe these African places are so poor and messed up because the people who live there make them that way. And then the next thought you have is that if European nations let great numbers of these people in for settlement, they'll turn European countries, or at least parts of them, into the same kind of mess. Mostly North European countries, actually. Life for an African illegal in Spain or Italy or Greece isn't that great. If they hike up to Germany or Britain or Scandinavia, though, they've got it made, with lax welfare systems to loot and lots of guilty liberals to appeal to. So the incentive for the southern European countries is not so much to stop these illegals as to keep them moving north. That's why nothing much is getting done. The North European countries are so addled with Protestant liberal guilt, they've incapacitated themselves from dealing with the problem. Here is kind of the same story over again. This is from the Associated Press, May 15th. Headline: Segregation Gains 60 Years After Brown. The essence of the story is that racial segregation in schooling in the USA now is as racially segregated as it was when the US Supreme Court decided Brown versus Topeka Board of Education back in 1954. Quote, around the country, only 23% of black students attended white-majority schools in 2011. End quote. Quote, in New York, California, and Texas, more than half of Latino students are enrolled in schools that are 90% minority or more. End quote. The nation's actually going backwards, the report tells us. Brown versus Topeka Board of Education is going into reverse. That would be Noitacud fo Akipot v. Nuob, I think, but don't quote me on that. This is actually an old song. Listeners who have committed to memory my world-bestriding 2009 bestseller, We Are Doomed, which I'll assume is most of you, we'll recall that into my chapter on education, I incorporated many facts about educational segregation taken from lefty Jonathan Kozol's 2006 book, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America, which laments the same lamentable reality and recommends a massive federal program of forced busing to remedy it. Okay, permit Radio Derb to limp up and explain it once more. One, we're talking about different races, which is to say common ancestors. Self-identifying American blacks average 75-80% West African in ancestry. Self-identifying Hispanics are a more mixed bag, but overall with averages 35-40% American Indian ancestry. Those are averages. We're looking at a spread, a statistical distribution, with many concentrations and outliers. Two, different races have different averages and spreads of behaviour, intelligence and personality traits. That's Biology 101. It happens in any widely distributed population of creatures under different selection pressures in different places. Those traits are all heritable. Talk to a dog breeder. Three, to succeed in American society as currently structured, and that includes American schools, it helps if your individual traits of behaviour, intelligence and personality have certain patterns. It hurts if they have certain other patterns. To succeed in school, for instance, it helps a lot if you can sit still and take in what the teacher's saying. If you can grasp complicated ideas quickly. If you can concentrate for long spells on reading a textbook. If you can not be over-concerned about socialising with your classmates. If you can defer gratification, and so on. If your traits go the opposite way, chances are you'll be less successful academically, though you might, of course, excel in other spheres. 4. Whites and East Asians know from observation, and sometimes from experience, that because of those different distributions of traits, large numbers of blacks or Hispanics mess up a school or a neighbourhood. So they pick homes and schools as far as possible from those concentrations. 5. In a black-dominated city or area, the school system is really a jobs program and a patronage racket for black adults who would otherwise be unemployable, and who will fight like cats to prevent their iron rice bowls from being taken away. I could add a couple more points, but I think that's enough reality for one Radio Dur broadcast. I do try to measure it out in small doses. So long as we have our freedoms, which, if the Jonathan Cozols of the world have their way, won't be much longer, so long as we have our freedoms, you'll get these patterns of residential and educational segregation. They're natural and normal. They're what people want. Well, of course, they're not what all people want. Some blacks and Hispanics would like to go live in quieter, more peaceful neighbourhoods with high proportions of smart, well-behaved kids in the schools. That's why I said this segment is a replay of the previous one. The motive force here is the same as the one driving Africans out of Mali, Nigeria and Sierra Leone. The Africans look at the prosperous, peaceful societies of Europe, compare them with the poor, chaotic and corrupt countries they live in, and say, "Hey, I want to be in Sweden." Next thing, they're in a boat trying to get across the Mediterranean. The ghetto dwellers of America look at our quiet, safe, clean, leafy suburbs, compare them with the filthy, crime-haunted streets they live in, and say, "Hey, I want to be in Scarsdale." Next thing, they're lobbying for low-income housing in the suburbs. Here's another quote from that AP report. It's from a young lady who's come to Washington, D.C. to lobby in support of public education. Quote, "Many blame the schools for failing, or teachers, but they never blame the bad policies put in place in schools." End quote. Go to Google Images and bring up pictures of American urban schools 100 years ago. They are not remotely up to the standard of schools in Kansas City, Missouri, where, a few years ago, under a judge's order, the district spent more than $2 billion on Olympic-sized swimming pools, language labs, a planetarium, lessons in fencing, violin, ballet, drama and theatre. Kansas City did all the things that young lady wants, but it didn't make a scrap of difference. The students of 100 years ago built the mighty USA of the mid-20th century, the nation that put men on the moon. Penniless Chinese and Vietnamese kids attend the worst schools we have and graduate on to Princeton and Yale. It's not the schools. It's not the teachers. It's not the policies. It's the students. Here is some news of the Clintons. But first, an erratum. In last week's broadcast, I passed some comments about Monica Lewinsky resurfacing. The lady had declared that, following her spell of fame, she had turned down many lucrative offers because, in her words, they didn't feel like the right thing to do. I expressed skepticism, saying that, quote from myself, Ms. Lewinsky did in fact submit to a primetime interview with Barbara Walters, for which I presume she was paid. Following that, I got an email from a person with some insider knowledge of the Walters interview. It is true, my informant tells me, that Ms. Lewinsky was not paid for the interview, though she might have got a little from the overseas rights. It's also true that she could have made a lot of money on the talk circuit, but chose not to because she believed people would think better of her for not taking the money. Of course, people just assumed she'd taken money anyway, and given the lady's recorded moral lapses, it was reasonable of them to think so. Truth is truth, though, and I'm glad to be able to make the correction. Okay, the Clinton news. This is all about Hillary Clinton running for president in 2016, of course. Will she? Won't she? Should she? I can't even believe we're talking about it. The president has to run the federal government. Mrs. Clinton's run nothing but the State Department, and didn't exactly distinguish herself there. There are 320 million people in this country, and this is the best we can come up with? For goodness sake! We are talking about it, though, and in particular, Karl Rove is talking about it. Here's what he said, in reference to a fall and concussion that Mrs. Clinton suffered a year and a half ago, at which point she was 65 years old. The official diagnosis was that the fall caused a blood clot on her brain. Here's Karl Rove, quote, 30 days in the hospital, and when she reappears, she's wearing glasses that are only for people who have traumatic brain injury? We need to know what's up with that, end quote. Now, if you want to tell me that Karl Rove is a loathsome reptile, I won't necessarily disagree with you. He does know a thing or two about getting people elected to high office, though. He got George W. Bush elected twice, and that was no mean feat, if you catch my meaning. I don't know which 2016 Republican hopeful has Rove on a $40 million retainer this time around, but it looks like he's going to get his money's worth, whoever it is. Personally, I won't vote for anyone Karl Rove is promoting, and I won't vote for Hillary. Enough of the Karl Rove glove puppets, enough of the horrible Clintons. Jeff Sessions for president. I know. Out there in listener land, yous all think I get my material for Radio Derb from the New York and London tabloids, don't you? Just to prove you wrong, here's something where I'm reaching a bit deeper. The topic here is that missing plane, Malaysia Airlines Flight MH370. My source is the Proceedings of the US Naval Institute. You can't get more respectable than that. The actual content here is Norm Friedman's monthly column in the Proceedings. Norm is a friend of mine and a seasoned military intelligence expert with decades of experience in the field. He describes himself as a defender of oppressed navies everywhere. In his May column, Norm looks at the disappearance of MH370 from a military intelligence perspective. He points out, for example, the limits of satellite technology at telling us what's happening on the surface of the Earth. Satellites close enough to give good detail can't stay over one spot. They just whiz by. Geostationary satellites, which do hang over one spot, are 22,000 miles up, too far for good detailed tracking. Norm covers all the issues relating to the plane's disappearance, weighing the probabilities. He doesn't reach any firm conclusion, but his closing paragraph is worth quoting. Quote, "A 4-hour gap in the story would leave time for an airplane to land and refuel, or to land and be destroyed, hence not to be visible on later satellite pictures of airfields around the Indian Ocean. Perhaps our picture of the world is not so complete as we normally imagine, with huge implications for military capabilities." This whole business about the N-word is getting out of hand. Over in Britain, a disc jockey at a local BBC radio station has been fired for playing a 1932 song titled "The Sun Has Got His Hat On." The song contains the lines, quote, "He's been tanning niggers out in Timbuktu. Now he's coming back to do the same to you," end quote. One listener, one, complained, and the DJ was fired. For goodness sake. Are blacks such delicate little flowers they have nervous breakdowns when they hear the word our grandfathers used for them? My guess is that they're not, and that the complaint came from some prissy white liberal, awarding himself moral status points for being offended on blacks' behalf. Just to show solidarity with the sacked DJ, who I note is the same age as myself, and also to express my own fed-upness at all this swooning, squealing schoolmarmery, I'm going to play you a song that's even worse than "The Sun Has Got His Hat On." This needs a little background explanation. There are a certain number of tunes that go back so far, nobody really knows who composed them. Most of them seem to be originally Irish. Here's the tune "Gary Owen," for example. Lily Bolero's another one. Some of these tunes were taken up as regimental marches in Britain and America. "Gary Owen" was, I believe, the signature march of George Armstrong Custer's 7th Cavalry. Well, in among these tunes is one called "Turkey in the Straw." It goes like this. Yep, you know it. It's the tune played by ice cream vans. At any rate, in the USA. Nice old American tune, right? Well, imagine the horror felt by Theodore R. Johnson III, an editor at National Public Radio. Just let me say that again for emphasis. An editor at National Public Radio. Imagine Mr. Johnson's anguish and distress at learning that this familiar old ice cream van song once had words put to it that made fun of black people. I'll play you a snippet of the song, which was recorded in 1916. You're not going to understand much, but I'll give you the words right after. Here you go. Got that? Here's what the singer's singing. Quote, "Nigger love a watermelon, ha 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 ha. Nigger love a watermelon, ha 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 ha. for here they're made with half a pound of coal. There's nothing like a watermelon for a hungry coon. Poor Mr. Theodore R. Johnson III was thrown into moralistic agonies on learning of this. What should he do now, when he hears an ice cream truck approaching, playing this tune, tainted with racism, and his kids come running to him for money to buy ice cream? Quote from his article. Do I empower them with the history of our country, or encourage the youthful exuberance induced by the ice cream truck? Is it my responsibility to foul the sweet taste of ice cream with their first taste of racism? End quote. Oh, the dilemmas faced by a bleeding heart liberal the third. I should say that, to his credit, Mr. Johnson tells us he just gives his kids the money and puts off explaining what a wicked country America is until another day. And now, Radio Derb's closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Banana-geddon. That's the word of the week. Banana-geddon. An incurable fungus disease is afflicting the banana crop in Africa. If the disease spreads to South America, that will be curtains for the poor banana. That would be a very sad thing. Possibly you don't care a whole bunch, but I like bananas. I slice one into my breakfast oatmeal every morning. Someone once told me, though I've never bothered to check, that bananas are nutritionally complete. You could live just on bananas if you have a supply of water. So let's rally to save the bananas. After all, if it hadn't been for bananas, we'd never have heard of Harry Belafonte.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Item, the celebration of freakishness and the marginalisation of the normal took another step forward last week when the Eurovision Song Contest was won by a chap named Tom, who had, for some reason, dressed up as a woman while keeping his beard. This isn't as peculiar as it sounds. The Eurovision Song Contest was already camp back in the 1970s when the Monty Python show was making fun of it. Not very surprising that 40 years on it's a whole lot camper. The thing that snagged my attention was Tom's chosen stage name, Conchita Wurst. Excuse me? Conchita is Spanish for little clam. Wurst is German for sausage. So we have a sausage and a little clam. A bearded clam. Oh boy. Can pop culture get any lower? Item. Finalmente, following up on last week's report about Procol Harum kidnapping schoolgirls in Nigeria to convert them to Islam, it seems they've started a trend. This week, we learned that Jefferson Airplane have kidnapped several youngsters in Nevada, demanding they all become acid heads. The Bee Gees have kidnapped some Aboriginal schoolgirls in Australia with the intention of turning them to disco dancers. The Village People have kidnapped a group of school boys for reasons unknown, and Jerry and the Pacemakers have hijacked a ferry. It's a fallen world, all right. If you see a bunch of aging rockers cruising around the streets of your town, lock up your kids. That's it, ladies and gents. To see us out, let's hear a little more of Turkey in the Straw. I never used to like it much, but now it's growing on me for some reason. In fact, I've decided to make it my new cell phone ringtone. I was getting tired of Dixie. More from Radio Derb next week. Here's the Tennessee Mafia Jug Band. Take it away, guys.